Self-Evident is a podcast that is dedicated to speaking truths that were once self-evident, but doing so in love. Hail and Wilma, everybody. My name is Jenna, and today I have my lovely co-host with me, Fren. She is back from the dead. She is living, actually, which is crazy for everybody to know. Bryn, how are you?
I'm so good. College has been crazy busy, but it has been so amazing, and I'm so glad to be back. Thank you, Jenna.
Absolutely. We're really grateful for what you can be doing with the social media content with Self-Evident. You've been crushing it in that aspect, but we finally have got you back behind a mic, and we're really happy about that.
I'm so happy to be here.
So today, we have a very special guest with us. If you have been following Self-Evident for a while, you will remember that back in June, we had the opportunity to sit down with some really, really awesome individuals to talk about their testimonies of living life as the opposite sex, and then detransitioning. And one of those incredible guests has rejoined us today, and her name is Maya Poet. Maya, thank you so much for making time to come back onto Self-Evident.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our previous interview. I think you all are doing something that's fantastic, and your podcast is extremely professional, extremely well-produced. It's very, very impressive for people who are Gen Z to pull together something of this magnitude. So I really appreciate you for having me on.
Thank you so much. Today, we would love to ask you about what is going on with the war in Israel. Now, for people who are unfamiliar with your story, can you give us a little background?
Absolutely. So back when I identified as trans, and my parents wanted me to stop doing that because of the dangerous medical consequences that come along with those types of identification, they sort of sent me to study abroad in Israel.
Yeah.
And so I lived there for several years. And of course, I was living as a man, like both within ultra-Orthodox Jewish societies and Palestinian Muslim societies. And I speak four languages, English, Russian, Arabic, and Hebrew. And I was basically an Israeli-Palestinian peace activist while I was living undercover there as a man.
That is insane. Yeah. And this is why we really wanted you to come back onto the podcast and give your perspective about what is happening right now.
Definitely. Yeah. So I know, like, for me, I haven't stayed super, super up to date with what has been going on with Israel and Palestine. So can you give us just like a little summary of what's been going on there?
Yeah. So on October 7th, 2023, the Hamas terrorist group that is governing the Gaza Strip, they basically launched a crazy surprise attack where they broke through the barrier between Gaza and Israel. And they basically just started, thousands of terrorists started going into nearby villages, into kibbutzes, into a couple music festivals where a bunch of, you know, young people, sort of peace activists, hippie types were partying and dancing. And they just, you know, they slaughtered people. They raped women. Yeah, I mean, they killed parents in front of their kids and kids in front of their parents, tortured them, and they took hostages. Back into Gaza, it was a really surprise attack. And I think part of the reason why it happened and why it wasn't caught is because the border wall had recently been mechanized. I think the Israeli government didn't want to put more of its soldiers in danger. And they just didn't realize how much sophisticated equipment Hamas actually had. Like, they were able to shoot down the sensors so that a breach wouldn't be noticed. And I think with drones, they did it. They did really horrendous things. And they also started shooting rockets into Israel. So normally, when these tensions flare up, I've lived through a few wars in Israel by now, and October 7th was by far the worst. I mean, because on top of having your rocket, just rockets launched at you, I mean, the barrages of rockets were insane, more than usual. And also, like, the attacks on civilians, I mean, breaching the border and doing the types of things that they did, it's just horrendous. Like, I lost friends, you know, on that day, and I was supposed to be at that music festival. So it's pretty crazy. But from that moment on, basically what happened, Israel, of course, came to the conclusion that, like, okay, we have been underestimating the threat that Hamas poses to us from a security perspective. And so what they ended up deciding is basically like, okay, we need to destroy its infrastructure and we need to get the hostages back. So there were two goals: get the hostages back
and then eradicate the threat.
Yeah, and eradicate the threat. The way that Israel basically, you know, conducts its military operations is that it has some kind of super sophisticated intelligence. They're basically able to figure out, you know, where the threats are, like where are Hamas's kind of weapon stores and things of that nature. And Hamas's military strategy is very much basically based upon embedding its military infrastructure with its civilian infrastructure. So they'll basically hide caches of weapons underground in this extensive tunnel system that they have built. It's like the largest tunnel system in the world. And yeah. They use international aid. They use, you know, Iranian funding because Hamas is one of Iran's proxies. Mm. And they use all that funding that is supposed to go to the people of Gaza to constructing this underground system of tunnels so that they can basically hide their weapons. And so the leaders can, you know, basically stay below ground so that the civilians can act as human shields above ground when there's when there's conflict. So yeah, Israel's had to deal with, yeah.
It's a very dastardly clever way to set up.
Right. And, you know, and Hamas has so much buy-in from Westerners because Westerners have really cushy lives and they don't understand how war works. And they don't understand that there are some people that just don't value life. Like Hamas doesn't value life. And it's not just Hamas. It's like any jihadi group. Like if you think about this type of terrorism, like they're fine to blow themselves up, you know, because they believe that they're going to go to heaven, that they're waging war against the infidels, the worst of which are the Jews. And so they're waging war on the Jews and they're fulfilling their holy commandment. There was this Israeli documentary done about a little boy who needed some kind of organ transplant. I think it might have been a heart transplant. He was like an infant or toddler. And he makes it from Gaza into Israel and they give him this treatment. The filmmaker asks this little boy's mom, she says, like, well, now that your son has a new lease on life, like, what do you hope for him? And she said, I hope he becomes a martyr.
Whoa. That is their goal.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah,
that's their highest goal.
I was going to ask you about that because the mainstream narrative here in America and what you were saying about Americans having very cushy lives and Westerners in general having very first world problems of, you know, oh, my car broke down. Oh, I can't get a good cup of coffee anymore. Those types of things where all of a sudden war is breaking out across the sea and nobody is actually registering the fact that people have different perspectives and worldviews. Certain worldviews and perspectives would lead someone to believe that their main purpose in life is to lay down their life for their belief. I think because Westerners have kind of pushed that aside. And a lot of Westerners, I know you may have run into this too, believe that they don't really have a purpose in life. So they kind of just drift like, oh, the best thing I can do is, you know, get a good education or get a good job and have the first class dream. It's impossible for us to comprehend the fact that someone would lay down their life for something they believe. And so what would you say to college students nowadays, here in America, especially, they're seeing all of this go on right now and they're blaming Israel. And they're saying Israel should not go on the offense and take these people out because, well, they're humans. You should have a respect for human life.
Yeah, I'd have a few points. So first of all, what's important to realize is that Israel is a tiny country like the size of New Jersey.
Yeah.
Surrounded by enemies all around it. And some of these enemies are more fervent and more like ideological. And some of them are more dangerous. And some of them kind of they don't want to mess with Israel, and some of them will secretly support Israel, but publicly never support Israel because, you know, it's part of this pan-Arab identity that was sort of manufactured really in the 1900s as a response to the creation of sovereign nation states in the Middle East, you know, starting in the early 1900s. So there are some broader trends within the region geopolitically, but Israel is surrounded by enemies.
Yeah.
And it's surrounded by enemies that want nothing more than to obliterate it, than to take it off the face of the map, than to just wipe it off the face of the map. You know, think about this. Imagine that instead of the entire United States, you just had like the state of New Jersey and the state of New Jersey was your country.
Yeah.
And then all of the states around it, everything, you know, everything from New York to Oregon to Canada to Mexico, everything in that region, everybody around you wants to obliterate you. And the reason why, of course, the Jews are obviously not keen on that idea is because Jews have been subjected to many genocides throughout history. So they know that diaspora, you know, all the countries that the Jews were exiled to and they fled to and they moved to once they were expelled from the land of Israel, these diaspora countries don't actually have their back. Yeah, so Jews can't count on anybody else. I mean, it's like the ultimate pull yourself up by your bootstraps type of story. Like, you can't count on anybody else. You have, you know, survived all kinds of enemy attacks. You now have a state a state that has to conscript every 18-year-old basically into the military,
yeah.
I mean, barring like physical or intellectual disabilities, essentially, because the threat is so ever-present. So if Americans, they obviously can't conceptualize what's going on, but let's say that some guy were to break into your house, rape your mom or your wife in front of you,
yeah.
and then execute your children in front of you, and then to take one of your kids hostage somewhere else to some other country, you wouldn't just be like, oh, let them do that. No. If this happened to you, if this happened to your family, and Israel is such a tiny country that it's like a family. I mean, everybody knows someone who's either a hostage, who is killed. Everybody knows somebody who has been impacted by this latest round of terrorism. If this were to happen to your family, there are no lengths that you would spare in order to get your family back. And so then we come to the question of, so why is it that there are so many more people dying on the Palestinian side than the Israeli side? You know, a lot of people think, surely this Israel wants this to happen. Israel is trying to, you know, obliterate Gaza. And the truth is that if Israel wanted to obliterate the Gaza Strip, it could in one night. They could carpet bomb Gaza. But they're putting their own, you know, soldiers in danger in order to conduct strikes that are as precise as is humanly possible. In fact, they will quite literally, with like their planes, drop a bunch of leaflets telling people in a certain area that's about to be, you know, the subject of some kind of military operation to get out. And the IDF, once it entered Gaza, had even set up a humanitarian corridor and had paused bombing and fighting in those areas so that people could evacuate. What ends up happening there? So like Israel takes, you know, extreme care that even the United States wouldn't take in preserving civilian life. Like the United States, it has been known to just invade countries just because there's a military industrial complex. And, you know, the United States had this little phase of trying to promote democracy in the Middle East and in like Afghanistan and in like those kind of Central Asian countries. Israel doesn't do that. They're not attempting regime change. They're not attempting offensive warfare. They're just attempting to like root out their threats. Hamas is smart and they know that Westerners value life. And they'll even say this. They'll say the West values life. We value death. These are the words that come out of their mouth. They see it as a good outcome if their child or their family dies in some kind of a bombing or in a terrorist attack, because that means that they are martyrs for Islam. They actually value that, and they know that Westerners are appalled by that. And so if they can basically play to the latent anti-Semitism that exists kind of ever presently across societies, religious and secular, you know, Christian and Muslim, from a racialized perspective and from a religious perspective. Like anti-Semitism is this type of mind virus that shifts to basically supplant itself to any given society in a way that is most persuasive to the people of that society. They're basically playing to these urges of like the Jews are bad. Jews are, you know, controlling everything. You know, the Jews are controlling the media. You know, the Jews are now they'll say the Jews are Nazis. The Jews are genociders. And so, and they know that they can, the more Palestinians who die, they can get more international funding. And so they've basically created this incredible marketing scheme where whenever they do get humanitarian aid, like whenever they get, you know, money, they use it to basically build this underground tunnel system. And they don't let the civilians just go into the underground tunnel system. It's not a bomb shelter. It is for the leaders and it is for the weapons that they have stored because they don't want Israel to attack their weapons. They're fine with Israel attacking their civilians because they don't care about the lives of their civilians. You know, they use international aid money to basically fortify their military infrastructure. They know that Israel is going to do whatever is in its power to not just indiscriminately go after civilians.
Right.
And Gaza is a very densely populated area. There are like 2.2 million people in Gaza, and half of them are under the age of 18 because Palestinians have a ton of kids. And so, and you think about this tiny little strip of land, it's very densely populated and it's ruled by terrorists. And so what ends up happening is basically just that if Israel drops a leaflet saying you need to evacuate, and sometimes they'll drop leaflets if it's to a big group of people, or if they need to bomb like a building because there's like some Hamas infrastructure underneath, they will call the heads of the house in those families and say, you have an hour, you have 2 hours, grab some things, get out.
The argument, though, that I've heard combat it when I've brought this point up, they're always claiming that Israel is very, very careless with what they do. And when I bring up the point, well, they have alerted people beforehand that, you know, we're going to be conducting military operation here. You need to evacuate. Some of the people that I've talked to say, well, where can they go? Well, the countries around the Gaza Strip are not letting refugees in. So this is still Israel's fault.
Right. So the situation that you bring up is obviously quite complex in that, you know, starting in really, I think it was the 1950s, although it definitely had its roots before, but where this, there was this kind of ideological shift in the 1950s, more and more of the Middle East had gone from being basically ruled by tribes and clans to having borders and sort of a sovereign citizenry. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
when the unit of political operations shifted from tribes and clans into like countries with borders and leaders, there was this almost ideological, this new ideological birth called pan-Arab nationalism. So there was this idea of, we're not Syrians, Jordanians, Lebanese, or Algerian, or whatever. We're all Arab. We're all part of one Arab nation. We're all part of one Arab brotherhood. And so, and this is new. This was very new because before there were even nation states or just sovereign states in the Middle East in general, these societies, like their unit of political operation were first and foremost families, and their families are very large, and then clans. So a few families together would form a clan. And so if one member of one family got killed, then the heads of both of these clans would basically hash it out. And usually there would be like either some kind of like settlements, like, you know, monetarily or with goods, or they would just straight up kill each other. They basically policed themselves in that way. There weren't like external courts that sort of everybody, regardless of their status or whatever, would go to.
Internal justice.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why whenever the United States tries to do democracy promotion in the Middle East, it doesn't work. The locals don't buy in. They don't buy into that. You know, they have a certain highly collectivist society. It's very tribal. And courts, external courts, like in most of these countries, don't have any legitimacy. They just don't. So there's this pan-Arab nationalist movement, but it seems as if that was mostly, it was like all talk, because when it comes to like the needs of, for example, Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, you know, across the Middle East, Palestinian refugees are treated horribly. They're treated like second-class citizens, even if they've been in, like in Lebanon, if you're a Palestinian refugee and, you know, your family came there in like 1947, 1948 to escape the fighting, they still don't have citizenship. They're still confined to ghettos. They're not like legally allowed to work. Like they have to basically scrounge together their own income and survive on international aid or on money from Palestinian political groups, like the Palestinian Liberation Organization. So it's been like 70 odd years, and they are still, even though they are like by all metrics Lebanese, like several generations born in Lebanon, they hang on to this Palestinian identity. Because they're not integrated, and that's all by design. If the Arab world decided to integrate these Palestinian refugees, who by all who for all intents and purposes are by now like, you know, Lebanese and Syrian or whatever it may be, if they were to do that, then the steam behind the rage, I guess, behind the Palestinian movement would totally disappear. And so paradoxically, you know, you would think that all these Arab countries would be like super rah-rah about helping the Palestinians. But the truth is that now these countries have been countries over 50, 60, 70 years. In some cases, they're, you know, a couple decades older than that. But you have to remember that countries, like actual sovereign states in the Middle East, is a very, very recent phenomenon. These countries now have actual responsibilities of, you know, they have responsibilities over their citizens. It's they understand that now this type of they at least have to have the appearance of being a legitimate state that's not tribal, that's not based on tribalism and sectarianism. So now that they have this responsibility to their citizens, and they've seen the type of havoc that Palestinian, you know, activists have wreaked on their societies, like when the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or in Arabic their party is called Fatah, I think you call it in English. When these people from the PLO basically exiled into Jordan or they got into Jordan, they basically took control of the entire place. They attempted a lot of political assassinations. They basically, and they even started like trying to direct traffic. They tried to assume the role of the entire government. And so obviously, you know, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan did not take too kindly to this. And so, and in Lebanon, you know, same thing happened, but worse, because these types of Palestinian operatives were basically trying to, you know, mass murder Christians. In the surrounding Arab countries, the Arab world knows that these, you know, that these radical, like, kind of Palestinian liberation ideas end up hurting their countries and their own citizens, although their own citizens are not as much of a concern as the fact that this is a massive threat to their political power. So when the Palestinians can be used to fortify their political power, then it's like, okay, we'll keep them disenfranchised, we'll keep them as second-class citizens, and we're buying into this like pan-Arab framework. But from the moment that these types of ideological individuals and groups actually threaten their grip on power, then it's just all out chaos. And so they, you know, they don't want an influx of people from Gaza in their countries, because it, like, a lot of these countries are failed states. I mean, Egypt by now is basically a failed state, Lebanon as well. I mean, I have friends in Gaza, like Palestinian friends in Gaza, and I've helped to fundraise to get some of them out. I mean, the overall culture there is very, very radical, very extreme, but you do have some real outliers. Like, you have, like, I know this guy, and he just has like two kids. I'm not going to, you know, divulge any information for his own safety, but he's a non-believer. He doesn't believe in Islam. He's actually a total atheist, which is just totally nuts for that society.
I was going to say.
It's nuts. And his kids don't even know, because if his kids were to know, they would say stuff, because kids are yappers. They just talk, you know, and they don't realize the consequences of what they say. And this could get the whole family killed. So he like, his wife wears hijab, and I don't even know, like, if she knows that he's a non-believer. I helped fundraise to get them out of Gaza and into Egypt. And what Egypt was demanding was their visa, $5,000 per person just across the border, just to get into Egypt. Right. And so you think about families with tons of kids, that's impossible. And so, like, and that doesn't include any social services for them when they get there. Like, they have to, you know, rent an apartment. They have to fend for themselves, and they don't know, like, when they're going to get kicked out. Like, there's no security. They're not even given visas to work. So they have to have savings, and, you know, they have to figure out, like, yeah, just how to fend for themselves. The whole, like, oh, we're all Arab brothers, this is all just nonsense. Like, the Arab countries don't do anything.
We actually just had an interview with someone named Annie Cyrus, and she actually was a former child bride that escaped from Iran, and she fled to Turkey. The UN helped her. So it was much earlier on, before a lot of this tension has happened. But her story too was, you know, she had to fend for herself. Yeah, she was able to get out of the country, but then you're placed here, and in Turkey, you asylum seekers were not allowed to work. They were not allowed to, like, have their own place. So she had to rely on the goodwill of others and fending for herself. When I hear this argument, it boggles my mind that this is Israel's fault. The countries around the Gaza Strip would want to protect their own borders for political purposes instead of helping citizens. So we've heard about the side of the Palestinians and their struggles about trying to get out, but what about the other side? When Ali Beth Stuckey recently released her book of Toxic Empathy, her goal was to show that the left always presents with an empathetic argument. Hey guys, it's Jenna. You just listened to part one of our discussion with Maya Poet, a former civilian of Israel, as she shared her insights as to what's happening in the Middle East. Part two will be out soon, and in it we will hear Maya's personal story of surviving October 7th and the days that followed, and how Israeli citizens are faring today. You'll not want to miss it. To find Maya online, head on over to X, where she can be followed at ThePeacePoet99. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Until we meet again, let us firmly rely on the protection of divine providence. This is Self-Evident.